Hello.
And welcome to the latest episode of
Season to Taste.
In the last episode, we were sent off by the randomizer to Season 24 and we decided to watch Paradise Towers. Matt, what did you think of The Paradise of Towers?
Despite the fact that there's some very obvious things wrong with it, it is immediately better than any Doctor Who story broadcast in the previous 2 years. The Doctor is actually the Doctor again, having not been really for the last 2 years. And it's actually a programme that I'm interested in watching again.
I think it's really interesting. I mean, it's fun and enjoyable, and we can talk about the plot and stuff in a bit. But the approach of it, it is, to me, the thing that jumps out, is it's so theatrical. It's a really stylized... It's the kind of thing you imagine seeing on kind of a fringe theatre stage. The Kangs and the caretakers and the Resis, none of them are really real people. They're all kind of microcosms, and the ideas of like the Kang language and stuff is a very theatrical way of presenting the characters rather than a very, very realistic one.
I think it's incredibly 1980s. I don't know whether this is just my kind of half-remembered vision of the 1980s, whether it was actually like that for people who are a bit older than me at the time, but you see things like the comic strip when they do sci-fi type parodies, and they all look a bit like Paradise Towers. It's all people in funny wigs and very earnest, almost a kind of both earnest acting, but also it has a genuine kind of social point that it's trying to make. And I think the only time we've really seen that in Doctor Who for the last couple of years is in Vengeance on Varos. This is the first time where it feels like someone's actually trying to write something that has a social point to it.
Yes, and that very much is symptomatic of the Cartmel era as a whole. You suddenly get the feeling Doctor Who is writing stories about things, about the real world.
Yeah.
For the first time, I mean, aside from little moments like certain Robert Holmes scripts here and there, it, en masse for the first time since the Barry Letts era.
Yeah.
And I mean, we've discussed before this, that actually, rather than being diametrically opposed, the Third Doctor's era and the Seventh Doctor's era are actually very similar in many ways.
Yeah, and I think that's why, you know, fans in the early 90s who were massive McCoy fans that were writing for the New Adventures had such a thing against the Third Doctor's era because it was so close to what they were trying to do in the McCoy era, but maybe the politics was just a little different. Whereas any other era of Doctor Who, it's very difficult to discern what the politics might be. The Barry Letts politics are incredibly liberal, and obviously the McCoy politics are much more socialist, but I think they both have a political point that they're trying to make.
Possibly to an extent. I'm not sure. I mean, I think obviously the main thing that comes out of the Barry Letts ones is a kind of environmentalism and that slightly Buddhist underpinning. I'm not sure if they were especially liberal rather than socialist. I'm not sure that the McCoy ones are especially socialist rather than liberal. They're certainly quite liberal. I mean, something like the Happiness Patrol is, you know, it's anti-Thatcher, but I don't know whether it's anti-Thatcher from a socialist standpoint or from a liberal standpoint.
I suppose it
does have a big message of society coming together to and the communities working together, doesn't it?
And
yes, you do get that in Paradise Towers as well. It's about saying it's not a no such thing as society situation. The Resis and the caretakers and the Kangs need to work together.
I think so. I think, to be fair as well, I think there's a big conservative streak that runs through the Barry Letts stuff, which isn't due to Barry Letts, who's a well-known liberal. I think a member of the Liberal Party, I'm not sure, but probably from Terence Dix, who is much more conservative. But I don't think he's the kind of conservative who would gnash his teeth over Europe. I think he's more someone who is embedded in the traditions of England. And I think, you know, people like Paul Cornell pick up on that. And
yeah,
a lot of their writing's inspired by Terence Dick's conservatism.
And I mean, one of the things you see in the politics of the Happiness Patrol is, of course, right at the beginning, where, you know, whether you're Tory or Labour, you do notice possibly the comment on the coalition, the last yellow one dies.
Yes. Yeah.
But that's it. Actually, they have the colours of the kind of three main parties, although obviously they're also just primary colours. That's much more, I think, where they come from. Also, I think it's interesting when Mel's introduced to the Kangs, there's a real kind of, the Kangs are like working class youths although, you know, from the Sylvia Young Theatre School. whereas Mel is like this middle-class girl from Peace Pottage, just like, well, I don't want to be in your gang anyway.
And but
like,
she,
well,
we secretly does.
She secretly does. She simply has to rebel against her parents and be a Kang. Although, we noticed, didn't we, that there's...
I'm not even sure it's that. I think it's more that she's so middle-class that the thought of being not part of mainstream society is so abhorrent to her that she's willing to be part of any society.
Having arrived somewhere where there's a really strong group, she feels like she shouldn't be outside that group. She should be in there, you know, baking things for their bring and buy sale. I'd love the Kangs to have a bring and buy sale.
I suspect they do.
I do. I mean, we did notice that it's odd that Mel's wearing this blue outfit and the red Kangs are like, which type of Kang are you? Then I suppose she has red hair, so maybe that's what's...
Yeah.
Maybe that's what's confusing.
I think that's maybe where the costume choice falls down a bit, because she really ought to have been wearing something utterly neutral, like beige or something. Yeah. You know?
Although, I mean, as if her reaction to the Kangs wasn't middle class enough, the fact that she's determined to get to the swimming pool is her overriding desire in the story, is to get to the leisure centre and have a nice swim.
And she does, to be fair, she does look much more at home with the Rezzies, doesn't she?
Oh, yeah, having
her
biscuits
chocolate biscuits and drinking her tea. She's much happier in that kind of environment than she is out on the mean streets with the Kangs.
And obviously, although, and the Rezzies, of course, Tilda and Tabby a bit are like an evil version of Howard and Hilda from Ever Decreasing Circles. Interesting that one of them introduces the other as my friend, in like two old cat ladies living together.
They're clearly lesbians, aren't they? The thing is about the Cartmel era, a lot of the time in previous Doctor Who, that camp would just be unconscious. It wouldn't be deliberate. Whereas I think given the writer of Paradise Towers and given the era, I half believe that it's deliberately intentional, the whole lesbian reference thing.
Right. I think to some extent it's natural in the story, because if you've got a society where there are basically no men, aside from the caretakers, in the same way as, you know, like, naval officers on submarines for many months may end up toying around, you can kind of see that if the only companionship people have is kind of older women their age, even if it isn't a kind of natural lesbianism, there's going to be some... I think do you know what I mean? If they're going to have any sex, it's going to be with each other.
Well, I don't know. The caretakers probably... Mind you, they all look like leather bears, don't they? They look like they're on a night out from XXL.
I do think that's an interesting view of the end of the story. During the story, you have these three groups who are all very separate. The Doctor's involvement leads to them all coming together at the end, which is lovely, but you do have to go, the only men here are the caretakers, and the girls who are the Kangs are probably going to find that the situation the Doctor's left them in is less than ideal.
Probably. I think one last thing is that, obviously, there's Tilda and Tabby, who are, I think we agree, lesbians. But then Maddie is clearly not. She's clearly straight, and she's clearly hot for
pecs.
She's clearly hot for the chief caretaker.
Oh.
When she gets him round to look at her rubbish disposal, come round and look at my dirty chute. it's not the first time that Richard Pryor has poked round in there.
Oh, God. I do think, actually, the other thing about caretakers is that they are, and the style of the Seventh Doctor's era is, I think you can see the caretakers in the Happiness Patrol to some extent as well, and that kind of, they're like a male version of the Happiness Patrol, and their rules and their way of enforcing stuff unilaterally and on the society they're in. I think you see that again in the following season. Mm. But again, I think the Happiness Patrol is the closest story to Paradise Towers anyway in Doctor Who, isn't it? The style of it and the approach is... There's a real overlap between...
Yeah, I think that because they're both studio-bound and they both have that kind of bright primary colour and costumes against a very grey and grim backdrop.
And these constructed societies and constructed languages and catchphrases and things. Like, I'm glad you're happy, I'm happy you're glad, build high for happiness.
Yeah. Ice hot, Doctor. Ice hot. One thing that I love about the constructed society and the bit where I fell in love a bit with McCoy's Doctor is when the Red Kangs greet him for the first time and he really carefully watches and tries to replicate and respect their traditions.
With their Adam.
With his,
Adam
exactly,
and the Ants
with
dance.
His weird Adam and the Ants dance. But I just think that's such a beautifully... It's such a Doctorish thing to do for... Mm. Some of the Doctors, but not others. You can't imagine the Sixth Doctor, for example, bothering to respect the traditions in quite that way.
No, but one of the reasons I think Sylvester's so good in it is he doesn't do an exact replica, he manages to get across in how he's responding to the Kangs that the Doctor is, you know, trying to remember, is faltering in how he does it. And it's a really subtle bit of performance from McCoy.
I think for all that some of his melodramatic moments are a little fumbled as the Doctor, because he really does struggle when he's given stuff to shout. Physically, as a physical actor, he's absolutely fascinating to watch. He kind of flits around the edge. He's always doing something interesting. Flicking through the book, the little expressions he has on his face.
The one thing I think, and you can tell it's still him settling into the role and settling into the costume, I think the hat is overdone. He plays around, particularly in the first episode, with the hat loads, and he's putting it on and off and waving it around, and actually the hat is overdone and he needs to rein it in. But it's charming and
it is
very much part of his
character. And I think it's, you know, he's still finding his feet and he's probably got a reliance on some of the props to help him find... it sounds a bit wanky actress this, but probably to find the character. He's playing around with the props, and as time goes on, he becomes less reliant on, because he becomes more confident in the character itself.
So to look at another aspect of the story, the hideous incidental music.
Yeah, it's one of the few Doctor Who stories where there's an entire alternate soundtrack on the DVD that's based, I think, on the original score. I think the music is awful.
It is awful, and it's really... those stabbing Kef synths are so intrusive to a lot of what's going on. The one time I think the music's actually really nice is when everyone gets together around the swimming pool, and actually there's a really nice bit of music in that scene about them all coming together. It really complements it. But everywhere else, it is just horrible and so 80s nastiness and that harsh electronic sound.
Yeah, the music really doesn't work for me at all. I think it is utterly terrible.
Do you know what I also noticed, actually, in terms of the production? I thought there was some similarity to Ghostlight, the previous one we watched. Even there's handheld stuff. Even though there is studio-bound, there's bits of handheld when they're going down the corridors, and some silhouetting of the Doctor that's lovely, with the kind of light, the other light behind him, with kind of Wings of Akatan.
Yeah.
There are little decisions like that, and bits of direction that give it a real energy and a really strong look, even though it is stuck in studio.
Yeah. It does have that kind of lovely, clever look. I thought one thing that stood out for the story for me is that a lot of the McCoy era stories, a little inspired it feels by the Hinchcliffe stories, where there's some evil that was buried in the past which is returning now to menace the present. And here it's the great architect buried in the basement returning to menace the present. We're going to have, in the future, you're going to have obviously Cain rising from Iceworld, and then Fenric. You'll have the gods of Ragnarok that live under the psychic circus.
And then you also have not actual people, but objects. You have the Sword of Excalibur, you have the Hand of Omega, you have the living metal.
Yeah.
You know, it's either people and things from the past that are buried somewhere.
Yes.
I did think, if you've decided that your great architect is a complete psychopath, maybe don't actually lock him in the building that people are living in the basement. Maybe that's not the best plan once you've managed to trap him there.
Yeah, it's... especially when you've trapped him in two light bulbs. It's not a great effect, is it? The other thing that I thought was a kind of precursor for the McCoy years, and I guess for the entirety of the New Adventures as well, is in the fourth episode, the Doctor says, like, he'd heard so much about Paradise Towers, I decided to come and take a look. So right from the start, he's decided he wants to go there because there is something there that he thinks is off and he wants to investigate.
I want to know how he finds out that kind of thing. I mean, is it that, you know, he's on Varos and someone's like, have you heard about Paradise Towers? And is he just Googling and he's watching the internet forums about the places where bad stuff's happening? You know, is it trending on Twitter? Or is he just getting a mailbag? People writing to the TARDIS saying, you know, dear Doctor, please will you fix it for me to stop the evil of Paradise Towers?
Well, based on Battlefield, I like to think that a future Doctor has just left him a list of things that he needs to do.
Because that doesn't cause any cause and effect issues. Was it John Hurt?
Probably John Hurt, yeah.
I'm just blaming everything on John Hurt now. So one thing we haven't touched on is perhaps the hilariously moustached elephant in the room with Paradise Towers, which is Richard Pryor's performance.
A brave performance. performance.
A very courageous performance, Richard. I was thinking the other day that you can kind of see, given how theatrical it all is, given how everyone is a kind of representation of a character rather than a real person, you can see how it fits in to have such a larger-than-life, over-the-top, stagey performance, because actually that's what the Kangs are like, it's what the caretakers are like, it's what the Rezzes are mostly like, but it does end up just being a bit farcical, doesn't it?
It's one of those things where I wonder whether people thought it was funny in rehearsals, and because it made the cast laugh, they didn't bother doing anything about it, or whether everyone else was trying for one thing, and because Richard Briers was a big name, no one felt that they could approach him and say, can you not try and do it slightly differently? I'm just not sure how that got through rehearsals and actually got onto screen, because, you know, for several weeks, people would have been aware that that's what he was going to do. It's not like he did it.
But that's why I think if it's a conscious decision and actually to say, well, look, the guy is crazy, and how there are different ways you can play that, but one of them is just out and out scenery chewing madness.
I guess, but it's not like he goes scenery chewing when he's been possessed by Coragnon. His characterisation doesn't massively change before.
I think it is.
After.
I mean, he's been.
He slurs a bit more.
Yeah. I mean, he's been. And walks in that as a zombie. But he's when he's the chief caretaker as normal, he is just quite. He's very much like, well, this is the rule book and we have to follow it. And it's a very stereotypical type of nerd voice, but at the same time, that's what the other caretakers are like as well, and it kind of makes them a bland, you know, they all wear grey compared to the exciting running around fun Kangs.
Yeah.
So I think when he's doing the kind of, oh, I hope you're all right, my pet stuff, I kind of think it's all right. Whereas it's much different. When he's possessed by Coragnon, he is much more over the top and much more.
Yes, yeah.
So I think there is a difference, and I think it works much better as the chief caretaker than as Coragnon. But I can see why in such a stagey show, it would maybe feel like it was the right thing to do, even though it ends up just being, I think, alienating the audience a bit.
It does. I think my favourite scene for the chief caretaker is, I think it comes in episode 3, where the Doctor has his Columbo moment, and he's basically, the chief caretaker knows he's not the great architect, and the Doctor teases out of him what his real plans are and what's really going on. I think that's a lovely moment for McCoy, and I think it's probably the moment where Briar's performance is best, but I just think it's the wrong performance, and I think it's hard to defend, even in a very theatrical piece. It
crosses a line.
It crosses a line into almost parodying the material rather than playing with it.
One other thing I think is a weak part of the story is that awful swimming pool monster that both looks kind of cute, but also is really, really obviously there. And you're like, how, Mel, how are you so blind that you can't see in the swimming pool this giant yellow creature?
Yeah. I mean, I think the swimming pool's another slight problem, because obviously it looks quite...
Is it on location?
It's on location at someone's house. It looks nice, but given it's meant to be one of the famous things about Paradise Towers, it does look like a pool in someone's garden. They really needed to maybe go on location to an Olympic-size swimming pool or something, you know, and have... You could have got away with that monster in a huge...
It needs to be like a rooftop, open-air,
gorgeous,
sunny sky pool, doesn't it? Yes, and if that creature was in a much bigger expanse, but it's such a small pool, it's clearly just there in front of you.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things in Doctor Who where you have to accept the budget is insufficient to
swimming pools
meet
never
the vision.
Actually, the only swimming pool that does, I'd forgotten there is one. The one swimming pool that looks good in Doctor Who is the one in School Reunion, because it is a proper swimming pool and it's supposed to be in a school.
Pool, yeah.
But yeah, the TARDIS swimming pool looks as out of place in the TARDIS as the Paradise Towers one, because it doesn't look like the rest of Paradise Towers.
Yeah. One thing that I do think is interesting, Russell T Davies is known for doing vertical storytelling. He loves his stories that take place across levels of a building or
up the game station.
You know, up the game station, the different levels. You've kind of got the up and down of the Partners in Crime story where
New Earth as well, they're climbing up.
Absolutely. So he loves stories where there's a kind of scale to them, and I think Paradise Towers does do that really well. The swimming pool obviously represents heaven, and it's up in the sky, and it's beautiful, and there's all these statues about, And then in the basement, there's this horrible, belching, hellish creature. And
I didn't even know Eric Saywood was still working on the show.
I think it's quite a neat form of storytelling, and it does give it a sense of a real place.
Mm.
Because as you go up the building, it becomes a bit more salubrious.
Mm. Yes. The other person I should mention, I guess, is Pex, who is the one who doesn't fit any of the groups. And I think, actually, he's a quite silly character, and he's supposed to be quite a silly character, but he's got the lovely idea for the story that he's actually kind of not even a conscientious objector so much as a proper coward who sacrifices himself at the end. It's actually a really lovely moment, and the little tribute to him at the end is a really touching way to end what has, you know, up to that point is a quite brash, silly story. It's a really, and the way it brings everyone together and makes his death a really significant plot point, I think it's a really nice little job, and it's a nice, well-executed idea.
That's quite interesting, isn't it? Because it's not the last McCoy story that finishes with a funeral.
No.
And there's a lot of stories that have scenes set in graveyards, even if they don't finish in a graveyard. It's obviously Fenric, but also there's the scene in Battlefield.
There's a scene in there's the scene in the Happiness Patrol with the kind of with the workers dressed up in a kind of funeral cortege as their protest.
So I don't know what it means.
There's the hearse in Greatest Showman Galaxy. Yeah.
It kind of is an image that kind of keeps recurring. This image of death and.
I think Summation Paradise Towers is it's a fun story. It's got loads of good ideas. What I like about it most, and what I think is a sign of what's to come in the Carmel era, is that it's really ambitious. It actually wants to do something worthwhile, and while maybe the execution is brash and an audience might just treat it as a bit too much like a CBBC kids show, the actual ideas behind it are really strong. There's a real desire to create an interesting world, to play with language, to have political elements deal with issues as well, like generational inequality, which weren't even trendy in the 80s, but it's certainly there, about like how the young people, a lot of people have been affected. There's elements of pacifism in there about, you know, no one even knows, after that, well, no one even knows what the war was for. It's never even, it's not touched on, it's just a throwaway, there was a war, we don't really know why, it's what happens, isn't it, people have wars. And, you know, the inventiveness of the Kang names, it's got so many interesting ideas in, and you know, it's not a perfect story by any means, but I love that it's trying really hard to do something different and interesting.
For me, it just starts the rebirth of Doctor Who in its last few years, because for the four series preceding it, Doctor Who's really just been about itself, and Paradise Towers isn't about Doctor Who. It's a story about lots of things, but none of them have anything to do with Doctor Who's continuity, and that, after the last 4 years, is something pretty unique and to be valued.
I was going to suggest that we talk about, as that was our last McCoy, that we talk about McCoy more widely, but I think we've actually done that in the way we've talked about Paradise Towers. We have, however, had an email to the podcast. Richard has emailed saying that when we talked about season 26, we discussed briefly that we thought there were certain Doctor Who stories that were 10 out of 10, and that Survival and the Curse of Fenric were two of those, and Richard, if that is his real name, thought perhaps we should discuss actually why we thought those were 10 out of 10 stories, rather than, because they were a slightly throwaway comment, and what we particularly loved about Survival and the Curse of Fenric, just quickly.
I think there are three 10 out of 10 McCoy stories, because both of those are slightly inferior to the best
Remembrance
story of the entire late 80s, which is Remembrance. Why do I think they're 10? I think that's quite hard, isn't it? Because I think 10 out of 10 is as much based on personal taste as it is on actual quality.
I mean, I think I said at the time, to be a 10 out of 10 story is basically to be an 8 or 9 out of 10 story that has something extra that you personally go, that's amazing. And actually, I do love Remembrance as well. They were for my list of 5 rather than yours, it just happened we agreed on them. I mean, I think in both cases, again, they're very ambitious. They're really keen to be about something. They have great ideas, great moments. I think the script of Survival is one of the most interesting Doctor Who scripts ever written. It kind of comes sideways from Roland Munroe from a completely different background. You know, not someone who's just churned out Doctor Who runarounds for 10 years. It's someone who's kind of got a really interesting idea of the whole Survival of the Fittest element. It's not a perfect story, you know, there's the odd bits of acting, there's the stupid motorcycle thing that don't quite work, but the ideas are so strong, and there's some wonderful lines of dialogue in it. It's just like it comes together as a beautiful piece, yeah. And the way it uses Ace is it's a very new serious thing of actually making the companion a real part of the story that you get with Ace in a lot of hers.
For me, survival, I think your point about the bits that are embarrassing, to be fair, there's bits that are embarrassing about pretty much every...
Yeah, even the case of Anjazani has the magma beast.
If you can't get past that, then you're probably never going to find a 10 out of 10 Doctor Who show. For me, the thing about survival, the two things that elevate it in my mind to being just almost like the Pathfinder for the new series is that scene in the flat, in Midge's flat on the council estate, where the Doctor's in someone's pokey, grotty front room talking to a little girl. And suddenly...
Who in the subtext of it, has had her mum killed by the Master. Yeah,
absolutely. But it's the first time ever in Doctor Who, I think, where the Doctor's actually interacted with reality. I know that, you know, you've had the Doctor walking through Covent Garden to fight the war machines, or you've had the Doctor running around Gatwick Airport, but those are landmarks. That's that's Doctor Who running around landmarks. Apart from possibly the visit Third Doctor and Joe take to, I can't remember her name, but basically the widow in...
Is it the CSO kitchen?
Yeah, it's the CSO kitchen. Yeah. Basically, the only time I think it's ever happened before is when the Third Mrs. Doctor Farrell? Joe go and visit Mrs. Farrell, and they actually sit down in her front room and they have a conversation. Mm. And I think that's the only comparable scene in the whole of classic Doctor Who where the Doctor's actually interacted with the real world rather than some kind of, you know, Merry England version in the Demons or some kind of landmark. I think that's absolutely beautifully wonderful. The other thing is, I think it has, well, that sounds really pretentious, but there's something really universal about that theme of Ace's kind of coming of age and becoming a woman. And I think the fact that it's written by a female writer makes it interesting for Doctor Who anyway, because there's only been a couple before Rona Munro, and only one since, I think. But, you know, Ace's sexual awakening, Ace becoming a woman and using science fiction as a metaphor, I think it's the kind of thing that science fiction can do very well, and I just think Survival does it exceptionally well. It's beautiful.
And Fenric as well, you know, all the stuff about faith, about the way that Ace, again, that those relationships with Ace and the other girls, Ace and the soldier that she's trying to tempt away from the prison cell, Ace and Captain Sorin, the way that chess is used, the way it pays off, the time storm and painful study and references back, the wonderful setting for it, which works really well. It's got really, and it's got, you know, really memorable characters. The woman looking after the evacuees berating them, and yeah, every now and again you have something stupid like in English from now on. But again, you forgive that because you also have We Play the Contest Again, Time Lord, one of the greatest cliffhangers, most creepy moments in all of Doctor Who, where suddenly this character who shouldn't know the Doctor's a Time Lord, it just emerges from nowhere. The, you know, the killing of Sister Crane, her name?
Sister George.
It's just full of really interesting, again, really interesting ideas, and it's trying to, and again, it's got that, and actually it's got the Barry Letsan environmental message in there as well, and it's blatantly anti-war. It's got the brilliant twist about Ace's grandmother, but it's not just about going, ha-ha, look what a clever twist it is. It's absolutely about Ace's character and about changing how she views her background and how she views her family. And it's a really engaging a story that feels like it has a huge mythos behind it, but at the same time has really strong characters and a really... I mean, the finale with that... How many times do you get a companion in tears begging the Doctor to stop what he's doing? I mean, that's why Ace is just one of the best companions, because she's the only one in the old series where she's really part of the stories and changes, and, you know, leader changes a bit. Obviously, Ian and Barbara are very central at the beginning, but Ace, the stories are tied to her character, particularly in season 26.
Yeah, I think with Fenric again, there's so much that's quite interesting going on, but it almost feels like it synthesised the whole of Doctor Who in its 1970 to 76 Barry Letts, Philip Hinchcliffe, Golden Age, and crammed them all into one story without it feeling in any way unbalanced. It has the Barry Letts environmentalism, political message, anti-war message, etc. And it has, you know, Hinchcliffe, evil from the past, rising to menace the present, cool monsters, gothic horror, is all in there. I think if you watch that, you've pretty much got the best of Doctor Who.
Yeah. I love season 26, I love the McCoy era. And that's the McCoy era done.
Yeah, goodbye Sylvester.
We still haven't met the first Doctor, we haven't met the fourth Doctor, and we haven't met the fifth Doctor. And we still haven't done a tenth Doctor either. Well, the randomizer is fired up, so without further ado, let's see which season we should taste next. Ooh. That's very different. And poses actually an interesting dilemma.
A twin dilemma?
A twin dilemma is an interesting comparison, actually, because it's part of season 21, and so obviously when we come to season 21, we'll have to consider whether we watch the twin dilemma. We won't. But it does cover two Doctors, and this season covers two Doctors.
Season four.
It's season four. So everything from the smugglers to the evil of the Daleks.
Although, actually, if we were using seasons in the true sense of the word, then season four begins with the 10th planet and ends with the Tomb of the Cybermen. Given that the transmission seasons in the 60s were very different from the production seasons in the 60s.
Well, we're not doing that, so it's So the options are the smugglers, the 10th planet, the power of the Daleks, the Highlanders, the underwater menace, the moon base, the macro terror, the faceless ones, and evil of the Daleks. Of course, there is a small problem with many of those stories that we've also not really addressed yet, which is they don't exist.
Yes, yeah, it's a shame that they couldn't have got the moon base animation out, or the 10th planet animation out by now, isn't it? Those at least would have meant we'd been able to watch the things rather than listen to them.
So actually there's no story, is there, that's complete?
There's nothing complete from season four, no.
So we're going to have to work out how to address that, which we haven't really thought about. So the Smugglers is audio. The 10th Planet we've got three episodes of. Power of the Daleks is audio. Highlanders is audio. Underwater Menace there are two episodes of.
Mm-hmm.
The Moon Base there are two episodes of.
Yeah.
The Macro Terror is audio. The Faceless Ones there's one episode of.
Two
episodes of the Faceless
Ones. So it's a six episode story.
Yeah. And Evil of the Daleks is only episode two.
Yeah, episode seven.
So either way, so we don't really need to take that into account. It's not as if we should opt for the one that exists, because nothing exists. Should we work through them, or have you got an immediate choice?
My immediate choice is that there's three series where we're going to have Hartnell for the whole thing to pick.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's right that we should pick a Troughton.
I think that's.
Other than that...
My only reason for not doing that is actually I've never heard The Smugglers, or read it or anything. I don't know anything about The Smugglers. But I think you're entirely right. We shouldn't knock off a Troughton when he's only got three seasons.
Yeah.
So that basically leaves us everything from Power to Evil. Of those, I've heard Power, the Macro Terror, and Evil. I've watched what exists of the Faceless Ones and the Moon Base. I've never listened to the Highlanders. I've never listened to the missing episodes of The Underwater Menace or the Faceless Ones, I don't think.
I'm kind of leaning towards The Underwater Menace. It's kind of nice, isn't it, to have a story that's suddenly 50% more complete than it was 12 months ago.
Mm. It's twice as complete. It's 100% more complete.
Yes, it is 100% more complete.
Yeah, I mean, I'm tempted by Power, because it's a very long time since I heard it, and it's obviously really interesting as that, you know, if they were going to find one episode from that season, I'd want it to be Power of the Daleks episode one. I want to see the introduction of Troughton. I think it would be interesting. Say, the Highlanders, it's another story I've never read or heard, so it would be entirely new to me to do the Highlanders. But I don't really know. Yeah, The Underwater Menace, I only know the two episodes that exist, so I'd still be hearing 1 and 4 for the first time. The Moon Base, I read the novelisation, I know reasonably well. The Macro Terror, I know very well, partly because I have a soft spot for it, because my dad's drama teacher is in it. The Faceless Ones, I'd be interested in, and Evil, I would, but again, I know Evil reasonably well, and it's seven episodes long. Which, is it just the Faces ones that's six? Or the Moonbase is six?
No, the Moonbase is four episodes. Oh. And Power is six as well.
Power six, okay. So Power, Evil, and Moon is long. And the Faces ones are the long ones. Not that we take that into consideration, but that's definitely in favour of the Underwater Menace.
I'd like to watch one where there's at least an episode that's there. Because I think even if one episode exists, it helps you to pin down.
Yeah, we know what people look like. How Professor Zaroff behaves and how Colin Jeevans behaves and how the fish people behave.
I think season 4 is one of those interesting ones, like season 19, where actually they haven't quite worked out what they're going to do with it now. So,
Is the Underwater Menace Patrick Troughton's Paradise Towers?
I think the Underwater Menace is Patrick Troughton's Kinder, to be fair.
Wow. I'm pretty relaxed. Let's make it quite simple. Let's watch The Underwater Menace.
The Underwater Menace it is.
Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.
Put our money on the GGs. Reference there to the production code being GG.
So, it's
niche at best.